From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. It is shaping up to be a very messy day of travel. As the Omicron variant of COVID-19 spreads, airlines are short-staffed and thousands of flights around the world have been canceled. Travelers and anyone else who wants to get tested for COVID before gathering with family are also contending with empty store shelves. Earlier this week, President Biden acknowledged his administration has fallen short on the testing front. Here he is speaking with ABC News.
Well, I don't think it's a failure. I think it's you could argue that we should have known a year ago, 6 months ago, 2 months ago, a month ago.
Let's bring in the political director at ABC News, Rick Klein. Rick, hi. Thanks for making some time for us and happy holidays.
Hey, happy holidays to you. Good to be with you.
So after hearing President Biden's interview on your network this week, how much do you think he's prepared for what's likely going to be a very tough January with Omicron?
It is. Yeah, it's going to be a major test to this administration, a test to Joe Biden and his leadership. Keep in mind, when he ran for president, central to his argument was that he would get it under control, that he would anticipate the next issues and the next challenges. And clearly, it's not under control. And millions of Americans who are gathering with family this weekend and through the holidays are not going to be able to get the tests that they wanted. That's clearly a shortcoming. And even in January, one thing that President Biden acknowledged to David Muir is that it's not clear what's the date or what's the mechanism. The website's not up yet. When are people going to be able to get the tests that he says have been ordered, 500 million of them? That's so far just aspirational, though. Right now, we don't know what the specifics are. So this could last a while in terms of testing shortages as well.
Yeah, yesterday on this program, we heard from a restaurant owner. This is a liberal Democrat who says he's lost all of his faith in Congress. His name is Steve Postel. He said his restaurant is closed because his workers, who are all vaccinated and boosted, by the way, they're testing positive for COVID. Let's listen.
The government knew this was coming. They knew it was going to happen. They knew they had to give us funding, and they didn't deliver it. And they should be replaced with people who can do a better job because they're doing a terrible job.
Rick, we talked about the president, but what about Democrats in general, especially those in Congress, hearing that message going into 2022?
Yeah, I think the relief package that passed early in the year was kind of a high point, a high watermark for the Democrats in Congress. Since then, a lot of the year has been marked by frustration. Now, it's not like the administration's been asking for additional funding, though. I think COVID relief has been sort of back burner. But I think one argument that you hear from people who are frustrated right now is, why was Congress focused on the infrastructure bill, the massive social spending package, when we didn't have COVID under control? The White House was warning about it at some levels. But it does appear that this moment has caught a lot of the people who are supposed to be preparing off guard. And the speed with which Omicron has taken over, the extent to which vaccinated individuals have been infected, we clearly weren't ready for that. And again, that's something that Biden and the Democrats promised to do better on than their predecessors did.
There was an interesting moment in this ABC News interview with your colleague David Muir when the president praised Donald Trump for getting the COVID vaccine effort started, which then led Donald Trump to speak kindly of Joe Biden and the vaccines in return. Here's Trump speaking this week with the conservative commentator Candace Owens.
The ones that get very sick and go to the hospital are the ones that don't take the vaccine, but it's still their choice. And if you take the vaccine, you're protected. Look, the results of the vaccine are very good. And if you do get it, it's a very minor form.
So polls show that people in areas that voted for Donald Trump are being hit hardest by the coronavirus. What kind of impact do you think hearing that from the former president might have?
I think it's a major moment. I think President Trump has clearly been all over the map for a long time over how to respond to COVID. The fact that he is now four square behind the vaccination and the idea of getting boosters, speaking in unison with President Biden is significant. I would note that when he mentioned getting boosted earlier in the week with a conservative audience that included Bill O'Reilly, you heard boos in the background.
Yeah.
And he had to tell them to shush a bit.
So
that
why is
tells
he doing
you maybe
that?
Well, I think he may not have control of some of the people in the audience. I think there's a good political argument to say he should be taking credit for the vaccines that were developed largely on his watch, that was a major achievement that happened with the backing of the Trump administration. I also think it's the right thing to do. I think he'd indicate that's where the science lands. It may just be that because Biden's being nice to him. You never know with former President Trump. But I think it's unabashedly a good thing to have the current and former president speaking the same kind of language when it comes to vaccines and boosters, at least for this moment.
I got just a minute here with you, Rick. I want to ask you about Joe Manchin. Many Democrats are upset that he basically said he wasn't going to support the Build Back Better social spending package. Mitch McConnell in the Senate is now courting Manchin to switch teams, to move to the Republican side. I don't know if that's likely or if McConnell's just kind of trying to stick it to the Democrats. But what do you think? What's Manchin's future with the party, and could he become a Republican?
Look, Joe Manchin survived as a Republican during the, or as a Democrat in a very Republican state where Trump is very popular in the Trump era. The fact that he did that tells me he's going to stay as a Democrat. But it reminds you that he's got the ultimate Trump card, so to speak, on Democrats, which is he can go to the other team. He could switch and be elected probably for life in West Virginia. Mitch McConnell knows that, and I don't think he's, you know, in threatening or daring him publicly. He's changing the equation. But that just suggests the limits of what Democrats can do with Joe Manchin. He's probably the only person on the planet who could represent West Virginia in the Senate as a Democrat.
And yes or no, does the Build Back Better law have any chance of passing in any form in 2022?
Any form, yes. I think they could get pieces of it. I think Biden is going to try to restart those negotiations. You heard it already this week with Joe Manchin after they flamed each other last weekend. The rhetoric has been dialed back a bit, and I think they'll try to pick up some pieces, although it's not going to be anywhere near what Democrats had hoped.
All right. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Happy holidays, and thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned earlier, thousands of people are trying to get home for the holidays, but many of them got an unwelcome surprise this Christmas Eve when several major airlines canceled hundreds of flights in the United States. Both United and Delta, they're citing concerns over the Omicron variant and staffing shortages. If you look across the globe, more than 3,000 flights have already been grounded. Now, that's according to the tracking site FlightAware. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan. He's our transportation analyst. Seth, thank you for joining us. What's going on here?
Good to be here, Peter. Yeah, it's what you said, staffing shortages related to the Omicron variant and just general issues. You mentioned United Airlines. United is an airline that took a stronger stance than others in terms of requiring its employees to be vaccinated. Well, that meant that some people aren't available who might have otherwise been available to fly planes and staff planes as flight attendants and so forth, whatever the merits of that stance it took were. And so you've got airports, particularly those where United and Delta are biggest with lots of cancellations. So places like Newark, yeah, where United has such a big operation, Atlanta, of course, the busiest airport in the world, where Delta is big. A smaller airline like Allegiant, smaller number of cancellations according to those FlightAware stats. When you see Allegiant with nearly 30 cancellations, that's actually a big percentage of its overall operation.
Mm. What do airports look like right now? Are they okay?
Yeah, well, it kind of depends on the airline, and this has been the lesson here. United, by the way, Gary Leff, who writes a View from the Wing blog, it's called, noted that United back in early November actually sent out an email talking about how good its operations were, that you could count on it for the holidays. Southwest and American of the giant four U.S. airlines had recently struggled with their operations. Well, today, if you look at that FlightAware data, American has about 10 cancellations. It's not very much for a giant airline. Southwest has just one. And it's, as you said, United and Delta who are in far worse shape today. So it kind of just depends on which airline you're flying. For some people, things are fine. And for others, very much not so.
Is it your sense that the airlines got ahead of this problem and canceled flights before people got to the airport?
Yeah, that is one thing they do a better job of these days is proactively or pre-canceling flights. So at least it's more often now than it might have been a decade or so ago, where at least you get that dreaded message in the comfort of your own home before you head to the airport or whoever you're staying with, as opposed to seeing it at the very last minute. But small consolation to people who are hoping to be having dinner tonight, perhaps with relatives, and aren't going to get there.
Very disappointed people across the country, I'm sure. But for those who did make it to their destination right now, they may be wondering what getting home will be like. What would you tell them?
Yeah, well, these airlines typically do get their hands around things. That's been the lesson, right? I mentioned, you know, if you sort of try to outsmart them and say, well, you know, what, win the last war, as the saying goes, right? I'll book a different airline. That's been the lesson here, is whatever airline is struggling a week later typically isn't the airline that's struggling, because they have some time to shift things around and minimize the pain. But it's always tougher at holiday times, because when airlines cancel flights and try to sort of consolidate the people, people from that canceled flight onto other flights, you just don't have as many empty seats on other flights. Now, if they cancel your flight, they're going to offer you a full refund. But that's, again, small consolation. It's not what you wanted. You might have prepaid for a rental car or a hotel room, and you're not going to get to the family that you paid to get to see.
Just briefly, Seth, travel had just started to pick up again. Here comes Omicron. Things are getting bad. What's the outlook, do you think, for these airlines that had a pretty tough time over the last year and a half?
Well, the fortunes of the airlines have always tracked the pandemic itself. So it's as you said. Now, we'll see going forward here, and there's talk about, you know, should people be required to quarantine less than in the past? I mean, as there's sort of variant after variant, and if it turns out that vaccinated people are not vulnerable to getting very sick and being hospitalized, you know, are people going to become less reluctant going forward? Maybe, but so far, Delta and Omicron have dealt big blows to the airlines.
Seth Kaplan on Christmas Eve, thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter.
On this Christmas Eve, we thought we'd revisit a story which hit home for a number of our listeners and me. It's about adoption, which has had a troubled history in the United States. For decades during the mid-20th century, millions of unwed mothers were sent away to have their babies in secrecy and shame. Those babies were often given to couples in closed adoptions, which meant that birth mother and child would lose their shared history permanently. Journalist Gabrielle Glazer told the story of one such family in her book, American Baby. It followed Margaret Earle and her biological son David, who was born in 1961. We spoke with Gabrielle Glazer when the book first came out in January, and I asked what led to Margaret getting separated from her baby.
Well, Margaret got pregnant out of wedlock, and in those days, it was actually illegal to have premarital sex in New York State, and her baby was taken from her by a very predatory adoption system that existed in New York, but also existed nationwide.
She and her boyfriend, George, who would later become her husband, were actually in love. I mean, they were committed to each other, but that didn't matter, did it?
No, it didn't. And despite their best efforts, they did everything they could to try to stay together. They eloped. They tried to convey their fitness as young parents to social workers in New York City. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter to the system, and it didn't matter to their parents either.
And so Margaret was sent away to a place that was, I mean, frankly, it sounded very unpleasant. Tell me about this home for unwed mothers that she went to.
The maternity home was a large old estate that was repurposed to house dozens of girls at any time. They were really kept under lock and key. Their diaries were read, their outgoing letters were read, their incoming letters were read. They had a strict regimen of chores to which each pregnant girl was assigned. They were watched as if they were toddlers at a preschool.
And when the baby finally came, they were taken to the hospital. They were forced to sign these papers. And then, I mean, the records were sealed. Once Margaret and those other girls let go of that baby, it was by design that she and others would never know what happened to her son.
Yes, absolutely. This was a system that had been established pretty much nationwide in the 20s and 30s. You would seal an original birth certificate and then issue an amended birth certificate that listed the child's new name and his adoptive parents as his original mother and father. And the theory was that it would protect the child from the taint of illegitimacy, protect the mother from the legacy of her alleged wantonness, but most importantly, it would protect the adoptive parents from anybody ever coming to interfere with their newly created family.
And this was happening at a profound scale across the United States. How common was it? And what was happening in the culture of our country at that time?
Oh, that's a really great question. The sexual revolution was simmering in the years after the war. We don't really think about it then because it's, you know, sort of tacked on to the late 1960s. But after the war, soldiers were coming home having not been celibate during their service. They were unlikely to want to be celibate with their stateside girlfriends. the culture itself was shifting dramatically. There was a new middle class that was exploding in the suburbs, and for the first time, young kids had privacy that they had never had before. They had rec rooms and their own suburban bedrooms, and really, pretty importantly, the backseat of the family Buick. So the rate of unwed pregnancies skyrocketed between 1946 and the late 1960s. And there was no abortion. That was illegal. There was no birth control, even for married couples in some states until the late 1960s. And there was certainly no sex education. So all of those factors combined to lead to about 3.5 million young women getting pregnant out of wedlock.
Wow. Well, can I tell you something?
Yes.
My mother was one of them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I got a phone call from her 2.5 years ago, and she asked me if I was sitting down because I had a half-sister that was born in 1970 that few people in the world had ever known about. And she told me that she went to a home to have a baby, just like Margaret did. And even last night when I was talking to her about it, 50 years later, when she told me about the day that she left her baby at the hospital, she was crying. I mean, her pain through this process was so incredibly deep all these years later. And I just wonder what you think the impact of all those years of secrecy are when you think about the women that you've spoken with.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm really moved by it. And when I heard the story about Margaret and David, and it's so interesting because David himself, when he told me that he had found his birth mother, that was the first thing he asked me, "Are you sitting down?" I found my birth mother. And it only happened because he had taken a DNA test that his wife had given him for his birthday. And
the same thing happened in my family. That is exactly how my mother found her daughter.
And when he first told me, and I think maybe, I'm sure your mother, you know, might feel this way as well, but he sort of had this faraway look in his eyes and as if, well, she probably doesn't think about me or maybe even remember me. And I just thought to myself, well, that's impossible. And I was absolutely convinced that somewhere David Rosenberg's mother was profoundly, daily thinking about him, wondering about his well-being, his health, what his life had turned out to be like. And it turned out that I was right.
She had been looking.
Yeah, she had been looking. She had doggedly, indefatigably left medical records. Once she and George had gotten married and she thought that this information was reaching him.
That was an excerpt of my conversation with author Gabrielle Glazer about her book, American Baby. And after it aired, we were flooded with responses from listeners who were placed in closed adoptions and had searched for their own birth parents. A man named York told us that he'd recently gotten an email from his birth mother. He asked us not to use his full name because not everyone in his family was aware of the story.
She says she's been looking for me her whole life. It's been wonderful. It's so bizarre. We are finding that we're ridiculously alike. We literally have the same truck. We have the same burgundy Toyota truck. I mean, that is crazy. It's just that feeling like this is my person, you know?
Before all this, York had done a DNA test that turned up one relative on his birth mother's side. So he sent her a message.
I'm looking for my biological mother. She would be related to you. You're my closest blood relative I've ever found. Do you know anyone who was 15 years old in 1968 and gave a child up for adoption in Southern California? And it could have been a family secret. And immediately she's just like, sorry, that's not ringing a bell. But then this woman had gone ahead and forwarded my email. And then it went to this one cousin and she immediately sent it to her sister because she knew. And that was all it took. Just steel yourself for whatever you find. Hope for joy, be prepared for catastrophe. But in the end, in your life, it's so much better to know than not know.
Cheryl DeVries hasn't had as much luck.
having moved back to the Seattle area where I was born, I did search for my biological mom. I went through all kinds of scenarios, like maybe she wouldn't be alive. Actually, that was the worst scenario I could think of. I never, ever thought she wouldn't want to know who I was. And that was a huge hurt to have that be what happened.
Cheryl hasn't given up hope. She's also submitted DNA samples with Ancestry and 23andMe. So far, no leads.
I think there's a part of me that just needs to see and smell and say some words and hear that story to feel somewhat satisfied. I don't, you know, and I just have such a big feeling of wanting to say thank you. It can't have been easy for her either.
And then there's the story of Joan Griffin. She told us her birth mother called out of nowhere one day. They kept in touch for years, but ended up having a falling out over politics. Her birth mother ended the relationship. Then, about a decade later, in 2019, Joan did a DNA test and found a close connection on her birth father's side.
And I crossed all my fingers. How is this going to work out? And it has been absolutely delightful. So for a year and a few months, I have been in like almost weekly contact with three brand new siblings. It's been an emotional roller coaster both times. I was young, a young mom myself when my birth mother entered my life and she came on really strong. It was initially very difficult and then became very good and valuable. And then, you know, it kind of went down the drain. Whereas this second one, because we're all older, and I think the silver lining of the pandemic has been that we've been forced to take it really slowly. And it feels very different. It feels very warm and inviting and inclusive.
And if you are still searching for answers about your family history this holiday season, we wish you peace and comfort.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Let's take a moment to remember some of the people who lost their lives to COVID-19 this year. More than 800,000 Americans have died of COVID since the pandemic began nearly 2 years ago. Belarmina Martinez was one of them. Martinez immigrated from El Salvador in the 1990s before eventually settling in Reno, Nevada. She had 8 children. Nearly 20 nieces and nephews. One of those nephews, Rudy Aguilar, called her by her nickname, Tia Mina. He says she was always the first one on the dance floor.
She would like take us each one at a time and try to get us, and we'd always joke, hey, don't make eye contact. Tia's coming, don't look. We'd try to push each other out to go dance with her.
Her younger brother, Adolfo Aguilar, says Martinez was the reason everyone got together for the holidays. She would always greet them at the front door with fresh pupusas, a classic Salvadoran dish. He says she was the matriarch of the family.
I told that to my nieces and nephew and told them, you know, she's suffering a lot. And we have to keep in mind that she is now at rest in a better place, knowing that she's suffering so much and finally resting. I feel at peace that she's already resting.
Belarmina Martinez died from COVID-19 in January. She was 66 years old. We also want to remember Courtney Isaiah Smith, a jazz pianist who was a fixture of Utah's music community. He died of COVID on January 25th at the age of 37. Candido Abeza is a saxophonist who often performed with Smith. Several years ago, when they were playing together, someone asked them to play the song Uptown Funk, which had just come out.
He just like listened to it once. He goes, cool, got it. And I was like, really? He goes, And that's when he told me, he's like, yeah, man, I got perfect pitch. Sure enough, we played the song for this crowd, and that was with most songs.
Smith played piano for the Calvary Baptist Church in Salt Lake City. He He also taught at Westminster College. Jasmine Olivo was Smith's partner and bandmate. The band was called The Mix, which she says describes their relationship.
I'm loud and passionate, and he was more quiet, more thoughtful, more creative, but in a very introspective way.
After Smith died, Olivo found a list of Smith's plans for the next 5 years.
One of his goals was write something that in some way will change music for the better. His last one was be in a place and state of mind worthy of marrying Jasmine. That was him right there.
That's what I want to hear.
Just two of the 800,000 or so people who've died of COVID-19 since the pandemic began nearly 2 years ago.
It's truly amazing that spirit of Christmas.
Oh, yeah. If you feel like you're far away from family on Christmas Eve, consider this. Astronauts on the International Space Station are orbiting the planet 254 miles above Earth. We were wondering, what's it like to celebrate holidays in space? So NASA gave us 10 minutes with Mark Vandehei and Tom Marshburn. They're both working on the space station along with colleagues from several other countries. We reached Tom and Mark on a Skype line, if you can believe that. And as you're about to hear, it takes a moment for the signal to travel through the Earth's atmosphere, up to the space station and back. We started our journey by calling into Houston. Yeah, that Houston, before NASA patched us through to space.
Please stand by for a voice check from NPR's Here and Now.
Station, this is Peter O'Dowd with NPR's Here and Now. How do you hear me?
We read you loud and clear. How is?
Great. All right. Mark, Tom, good to speak with you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you as well.
Well, thanks for being here. You know, I was thinking about this. No human beings in the universe are celebrating the holidays further away from home than you are. How do you feel up there this time of year?
We're very busy with work. So the holiday season, I think, is passing me by, at least. Christmas Day, we'll have a chance to have a video conference with our families. So we're missing the holiday season, but we're continuing to work just straight on through as we normally do.
Tell me what that will be like on Christmas Day. How will you spend the morning?
Maybe a fun anecdote to share with you is this same thing happened to me on my last flight. We worked really hard Christmas Day, and our Russian counterparts, they had the day off, and they went ahead and decorated their end of the space station with Christmas decorations and told us to come over for dinner, and we were very pleasantly surprised that they had a nice spread for us. So it's fun to be up here with wonderful people.
You know, I was just going to ask you that, Mark. You do have fellow astronauts up there from Europe, from Russia, from Japan. Do you feel an extra sense of, I don't know, international camaraderie on the space station this time of year?
Oh, I would say it's not just this time of year. It's all the time. That's one of the wonderful things about being on an international space station is that we get to train together all over the world and learn about different cultures. Part of our job is even learning other languages. So it's a very eye-opening experience, and the space station is really supporting all of humanity. So it gives us a very good sense of purpose. We feel really good about our work.
Tom, we've seen some pictures from 2012 of you and a Christmas tree on the space station. Is that tree still up there? And if it is, whose job is it to pack it on the spacecraft?
Now that you asked that question, I'm not quite sure. We'll have to go into our database and see if it's still here. Little tiny Christmas tree, about a foot and a half tall, and you could put it on the ceiling or the wall, either way.
Yeah, yeah. How else are you decorating? Do you decorate on the space station?
I believe we might have some stockings, not the simple cloth kind, that we'll put out. I think we have some Santa hats we might be wearing. So it'll be a festive atmosphere during the day to a certain extent, for sure.
I know there's a lot of kids who are wondering if Santa Claus comes to space.
Yeah, we're certainly hoping that he finds a way to get in through the airlock and come and visit us as well.
Look, you've said this several times. You're going to have a busy day working on Christmas Day, and I know it's not easy, the job that you have up there. You had to shelter in a spacecraft recently when satellite debris threatened to crash into the space station. I understand you also had to deal with an ammonia leak earlier this year. Mark, has this mission felt a little bit more stressful to you than most?
Apps, it actually has not felt any more stressful. I think we're so well trained that we get simulations where everything goes wrong. So when we have something that goes wrong and it's not the full complement of wrongness, it feels like it's an easy simulation. So the ground, most of the time in the simulations on the ground control team is not available to help us. And of course, they want to do everything they can to help us out. So that makes everything seem easier than our training. And it actually adds to the sense of adventure up here. That's been my feeling so far. Hopefully it'll stay that way.
Tom, what was it like when there was a risk that the satellite debris might hit you?
Oh, I agree with Mark completely. It was, we were up early, of course, but we were moving slowly and calmly and thinking, yep, this is like a sort of an easy simulation. We got to work hatches that normally we can't work in simulations on the ground. So it was nice to get to know our space station that way. We did find ourselves in our return vehicle, our Dragon capsule, with the hatch closed. That was a surprise. But we had some food and water with us, and we just waited it out and didn't have any concerns. If we needed to, we knew that we could just depart the space station. But glad that it all worked out and we could stay on board.
Tom, I see that you've been going up to the space station since 2009, and then when this rotation is done, you'll be staying on for the 67th expedition. Why do you want to stay longer in space than you have to?
There are certain aspects of living up here that you begin to miss over time, living in zero G, the view of the Earth, of course, but the prospect of having a chance to work with scientists, engineers, and centers all around the world, it's an incredible international endeavor. It was something I was very proud to be a part of when I left the space station. I talked to my family. They said they were okay with me coming back, and so then I just began making preparations to come back again if I could. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How are your bodies holding up?
So far, so good. We've got three different types of exercise devices up here. We've got a resistive exercise device that uses vacuum cylinders instead of weight. Off to Tom's left, there is an exercise bike, but it doesn't have a seat. Mm. And we've got a treadmill up here as well, so we can go for runs. But you need to be strapped down to that treadmill with bungee cords. You actually run on the wall. So it looks kind of funny if you're used to being one orientation. You see someone running with their head off to the side.
By the way, if you're near a window, could you tell us what you see outside?
It's interesting that especially when I first got here, I looked outside. I had no idea where I was. It wasn't like looking at pictures in an atlas. You see a lot of clouds. You usually see a lot of blue. And right now, we see a lot of blue.
It's an ocean.
And it's sunset. What's interesting, yeah. It's interesting right now, too. Our orbit is running along the terminator. That is the night dark line. So we often feel like we're in sunset and sunrise. That's a unique thing about our orbit this time of year.
Well, considering that vantage point, I wonder if the two of you could just tell us what your hopes are for the world as we turn the page on 2021 and we start a new year.
Wow, that's a great question. I think my hopes are that with COVID and just international affairs, that we have, as human beings, have a strong sense of unity. Also with climate change, that we recognize that we really are all in this together. And this very thin atmosphere, which is essential to our existence, most of us were always inside that atmosphere. That's a very finite resource that we need to protect. And it has a huge impact on us. I think the Earth is going to be around for a long time. Whether or not we are is really up to us.
Two astronauts aboard the International Space Station, Mark Van de Hei and Tom Marshburn. Thank you so much for taking some time high above us to talk to us. Happy holidays to both of you.
Happy holidays, too. Thanks for the talk.
Station, this is Houston ACR. That concludes the event.
And back here on Earth to help us mark the end of a long and sometimes difficult year, we asked the Here and Now staff to share a song that had particular meaning to them in 2021. Today, our producer, Lynn Menegon, who's normally responsible for our interviews about politics, tells us why she chose a classic from way, way back.
My song of the past pandemic year goes way back to 1632. It's Zefiro Torna. When I first heard it sung live before the pandemic, I thought, well, that's a swinging little tune. and I needed a swingy little tune to keep myself moving while we were all locked down. Don't laugh, but I play it while warming up for online ballet class. It's a formal poem set to music, but to me it's about the wind blowing things back to life. Italian composer Claudio Monteverdi must have felt that swirl of joy too. He had just survived the plague when he wrote it. Zeffiro Torna even led me to the letters of Monteverdi, where I learned that for many years this great composer had to beg his noble patrons to pay him. And regifting was a thing then. A traveler from Egypt gives him a monkey, which he promptly regifts to a noble lady, ending that letter with his characteristic sign-off, "Your most humble and most grateful servant, Lynn Menigo."
Once again, you may be hearing Christmas music a little differently this year. Songs like "I'll Be Home for Christmas" or "Christmas Baby, Please Come Home" taunt us when health officials tell us we shouldn't travel or be indoors with family. But one Christmas song has maintained its hopeful melancholy for 80 years. In one of our favorite holiday stories from last year, Katie Sewell of the Bittersweet Life podcast reports.
There is one song that stands apart from the others. It's wistful. And it's full of longing for bygone days.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
White Christmas was written by Irving Berlin, the same songwriter who composed Alexander's Ragtime Band and God Bless America. And people heard White Christmas for the first time ever on a radio show. It was Christmas Day, 1941.
Craft Music Hall with Bing Crosby, Mary Martin, John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, and the Music Maids and Hal. And here's Bing Crosby.
I like New York in June.
Bing Crosby and the Craft Music Hall was a show that mainly appealed to young people. So it's possible that the younger generation embraced White Christmas first. But the longing and coziness of the song had a deeper meaning that day. Families tuning into the Christmas broadcast were thinking about the tragic event that happened just 18 days before.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
The following year, in the winter of 1942, young American troops found themselves overseas during the holidays. An armed forces radio played White Christmas over and over to remind them of home. It's been a permanent part of the Christmas holiday ever since. Bing Crosby recorded the song for distribution in 1942. In an interview, he talked about traveling overseas to perform for the troops.
The song that is most asked for from me over there was White Christmas. Really got so that I hesitated about doing it because it caused such a nostalgic yearning among the men that it made them sad. And for this reason, several times I tried to cut it out of the show, but these guys just hollered for it.
By the end of the war, White Christmas was the best-selling song of all time. It held that distinction for 56 years. That is, until 1997, when Princess Diana died.
Your candles burned out long before. Your legend ever will.
Elton John's remake of Candle in the Wind was the first song to really challenge the popularity of White Christmas. But White Christmas is still a part of the holidays. And it may surprise you to know that unless you were alive in the 1940s, you've never heard the recording of White Christmas that made it famous. The radio premiere of the song on Kraft Music Hall was lost, and Bing Crosby's original 1942 master recording, the version heard by the troops overseas, wore out from overuse. The most familiar version is from 1947, when Bing re-recorded the song, hoping to recapture the original magic. For composer Irving Berlin, White Christmas was an unexpected hit. It was a simple song, just 54 words and 67 notes. It was written for a musical review about the holidays, a failed project that eventually became the movie Holiday Inn. Irving Berlin thought a different song from that film would become popular. Here he is.
I had a song in there called Be Careful, It's My Heart. That's the song I picked as the big hit. And it was a fair success. But I also had a song in there called White Christmas.
And that song won him an Academy Award and is still the best-selling Christmas song of all time. Which is interesting, given the fact that Irving Berlin didn't even celebrate Christmas. He was a Jewish man who immigrated from Russia as a child. And Christmas was a very sad and solemn day for him. While many American families opened gifts around the Christmas tree, Irving Berlin had his own tradition. Every year, he visited the grave of his son, Irving Berlin Jr., who died on Christmas Day, 1928, at only 3 weeks old. Perhaps it is this truly human melancholy that gives White Christmas staying power. 79 years after it first appeared on the radio, you're still likely to turn it up rather than off.
May your day be merry and bright, and may all your be white.
I'm Katie Sewell.
Thank you for listening along with us today. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. Happy holidays. It's Here and Now.